There's no better person to talk about connections between Vedic science and the Greek traditions, the Greek philosophers, the Greek religion, than Dr. Ken Chandler. Ken Chandler has a PhD from the University of Texas at Austin, where he specialized in philosophy of science and the foundations of knowledge. He taught philosophy at the University of Missouri in Columbia for almost 10 years before he came to MUM. It was MIU then. And we were just chatting before this started, and Ken came here in spring of 1978, and I came in fall of 1978, and I just assumed he had been here from forever. But for me, he has. He taught philosophy. He was the chairman of the philosophy department, and he also, of course, received awards for his teaching. But one of the most significant things that he did was he was the founding, one of the founding editors of the journal Modern Science and Vedic Science. And the introduction to that journal, Maharshi was so pleased with the introduction that he wrote describing what is Vedic science, how it's related to modern science, that Maharshi requested that that introduction be published in every issue of the journal, so that any issue of the journal you pick up, you can get that brilliant introduction to modern science and Vedic science. So it's been published throughout the time that the journal was published. Starting in 1989, he devoted his full time to development of consciousness and writing about the relationship between the Greeks and Vedic science. And the product is something that he will show you, a book today that he will show you. And it's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ken Chandler to you.
Thank you, Kathy. It's a real pleasure to be able to present this knowledge of the Greek tradition to you in the light of Vedic science. And what I found over many years, I've been doing this for probably 50 years, is that the Greeks really were an outpost of Vedic civilization. And if that term sounds a little austere or too harsh, to call our great Greek tradition an outpost of Veda, you could say that, well, the Greeks were a marvelous, magnificent fruit on the tree of Vedic knowledge. Or you could say the Greeks were a satellite of Vedic knowledge. Or there are many ways to say it, but the Veda was much more ancient than the Greeks. And the Greeks, for all their glory, and we in the West appreciate their glory very, very much, and we have, most people think civilization began in Greece, and that Greece was the beginning of the whole of civilization. And that's a common view today. They don't look beyond the Western origins of Greek civilization. But the Greeks really began to flower in the early 6th century BC, and they grew to be a very, very productive civilization that produced this magnificent temple architecture, art, sculpture, vase painting, drama, philosophy, the Olympic Games, democracy, you name it. That's where it all began in Greece. Well, it didn't really begin in Greece. That's the point. It began much earlier in Vedic India. The pre-Socratic tradition of Greece, which began in about 585 BC with Thales, was almost verbatim a replication of what, or a continuation of what had been going on in Vedic India, with the discovery of the ability to go within and know eternal being within the self, the eternal one. It's described almost in the same way in Vedic India as it is described in the Upanishads and the Yoga Sutras and the Rama Sutras and even the Rig Veda and the Ajurveda. So I'm going to just give you a little bitty tour of Greece, in case you've forgotten what a glorious beginning we had, there is no question that Greece was a very glorious state of civilization. And almost every scholar today knows this phrase, the glory that was Greece. First came from Edgar Allan Poe, but the glory that was Greece, the glory of Greece, it's almost universally described that way. This was a magnificent civilization and worthy to be called the beginning of ancient Western thought or the beginning of Western civilization. This is the Temple of Athena, Athena Parthenos, which means the virgin goddess of wisdom. And this is another view of the Acropolis in Athens. You probably know all of this quite well. This is the Temple of Poseidon at Sunion. You see just the remains of this civilization, but what a civilization it was. It was just spectacular in its output from about 495 to 433, 429, something like that. That's, dates will vary. Greece flowered in a magnificent civilization. So I'm going to just take you for a brief tour. Here's Apollo, the god of wholeness and light. Again, a magnificent, don't you, you feel the silence and the power in that, I suppose. I certainly do. And Apollo was said in the ancient world to drive the chariot of the sun across the sky every day. Apollo drives the chariot. Apollo, like Brahman in Vedic India, drives the chariot across the sky. And if he drives the chariot of the sun, he drives everything, because we know the sun is the source of all nurture and energy in the universe. Here's the charioteer of Apollo, another version of Apollo, sculpture. And the theater at Delphi, one of the most beautiful theaters, looks down this amazingly deep valley, very, very steep valley. A beautiful, beautiful place, and the Temple of Athena at Delphi. And here's a picture of the Oracle of Delphi consulting an Athenian. I would suggest that's probably the first picture of iPad mini that you'll see anywhere. And here's a Greek vase painting of Triptolemus of Ephesus preparing to travel into the underworld, or if you will, the inner world, on his winged chariot. What the Greeks called the underworld was a very degenerate form of what originally was probably a journey into the inner world. And here is Athena, the goddess of wisdom. The temple, the Parthenon, was built to honor Athena, and inside the temple was a huge statue of Athena. I think it was much larger than life size. It was made of 50 pounds of gold and something like 75 pounds of silver and ivory. The Greeks, after the victory over the Persian invaders, became very wealthy. And they built this temple and this statue to honor Athena, who represents wisdom. Well, what did the Greek philosophers understand by wisdom? Plato defines wisdom very simply. When returning into herself, the self or the soul passes into the other world, the region of purity and eternity and immortality and unchangeableness, and being in communion with the unchanging is unchanging. And when the soul enters this state of unchanging, simple rest, this is the state of this state of the soul is called wisdom. So what was the wellspring of this glorious state of civilization that we see in ancient Greece? Well, what I'll suggest is that the Greeks did not copy Vedic civilization. They weren't repeating Vedic ideas. They were describing their own experience. But that a technique of transcending came from Vedic India into Greece. And it came through Pythagoras and Zalmoxis, who became king of Thrace. King Zalmoxis is the one to whom Socrates gives credit for the fair word that he gave to his students to repeat every day so that they could attain wholeness, health, wisdom, and immortality. Socrates gave credit to the ministers in the court of King Zalmoxis. King Zalmoxis supposedly lived in a cave that he had built under his palace, meaning a luxury cave, of course, and lived in the cave almost his whole life with rarely coming out. And there were five different sources, at least, maybe seven, who talk of Indian seers in Athens by the 5th century, by the mid-5th century, by the time of Socrates. So what was going on that made Greece so great? What was the source of this great awakening, this great wisdom, this great output of creative effort and beauty in the arts and philosophy and the birth of Western science? Well, the Greeks had learned a technique of transcending, and it was promoted or passed on by the philosophers who described it, the technique, quite precisely. Plato and Socrates both taught it. Aristotle also learned and taught it. And transcending can be defined simply as the deep settling of the activity of the mind while the mind remains awake. Now, we tend to think in terms of a specific technique, which we know to be an effective way to settle the mind effortlessly into rest. But I'm going to talk in general terms about transcending, because throughout history we'll see that the great philosophers, not only in the ancient world, but I found throughout the modern world as well, describe the same technique of transcending, a technique of transcending. For Plato, it was a technique of daily repeating a fair word that brought this experience of wholeness, health, immortality, and immortality and wisdom. The characteristics of the state of pure consciousness that's experienced when the mind becomes completely settled are quite well defined. She has talked about them over many years, and also they were talked about throughout history. The great philosophers throughout history used essentially the same set of terms to define pure consciousness that Maharishi does. And this is a list that basically can be derived from Maharishi or from many other people like Plato and Aristotle who describe the same state. It's a state of silence and rest. It's one simple, unchanging, unmanifest, can be called quiet. It's settled stillness, sameness, evenness, abstract, without sensory qualities, undifferentiated, qualityless, formless, immutable, singular, and self-sufficient. These are some of the basic properties that characterize pure consciousness. And then there's three other categories in this table, and they correspond to, in the Vedic tradition, being, consciousness, and bliss, the three basic characteristics of pure consciousness. And of course, you know these very well: eternal, unbounded, unlimited, all-pervading, infinite, vast, indivisible, continuous, unconditioned, primordial, cosmic, universal, invincible, indestructible, and ever-present, a field of all possibilities. And it's, of course, consciousness, it's self-referral, it's pure wakefulness, pure subjectivity, consciousness knowing itself. And I won't read through them all because you're probably all very familiar with them. And then bliss, of course, unconditioned joy, highest happiness, eternal peace, a source of unlimited creativity and organizing power, and so on. So my method is to take this set of terms and say, I'm going to use this as a criteria. And I'm going to compare this list against what Plato and Aristotle and Parmenides and Heraclitus and Anaxagoras and Anaximander, all the early Greeks, say about consciousness. And I'll show you, and I can do this more or less exactly. I think it's a fairly exact way to proceed on the basis of criteria and evidence to show that the Greeks were describing the same set of the same state of consciousness as described by the same set of terms. So this is not just a vague intuition I have, I've tried to work it out in a criterion-based, evidence-based way. And I'll show that the Vedic tradition and the Greek tradition were both describing pure consciousness. And that the Vedic tradition, this is something else, if time permits, and I think we'll get to it. I see there's important new evidence that the Vedic tradition was far more ancient than the dates you'll find if you look on the internet or in textbooks or in scholarly books. Scholars put the Vedic tradition somewhere beginning around 1600 to 1800 BC. It's not even in the ballpark. The Vedic tradition was far more ancient than that. And I think there's good evidence, hard evidence for it. So the Vedic tradition was earlier than the Greeks, far earlier. It was at least 1,000 years old when the pre-Socratics began with this, the pre-Socratic Greeks began with this new idea, this what was a new theme in Greek thought, that there is an eternal, unchanging, unbounded field of being that we can experience. And I'll show two things, that they all describe a state that has these properties, and two, that they all talk about experience. And I'll do that fairly quickly so we can also look at other issues and other things, and then we'll take some questions. So anyway, this is the framework. Now, let's see, start with Aristotle and work my way back. Start, because Aristotle is very, very clear. Also, Maharishi just loved Aristotle. When I quoted some Aristotle to Maharishi, he just really thought it was the most wonderful thing. And so I want to start with Aristotle. And this is a statement that comes from his Metaphysics. Divine consciousness is the absolutely simple and unified consciousness of itself. Now, you can't get a clearer description of eternal, unbounded, universal, pure consciousness than that. Now, if you read most translations of Aristotle, you won't find those words exactly, because there's an issue of translation. The word nous, N-O-U-S, was the Greek word that Aristotle used, and it's often translated as reason, or intellect, or understanding, or thought, or thinking, even. But nous, Aristotle himself says very clearly, nous is one, simple, unchanging, and conscious of itself for eternity. He's not talking about thinking, or intellect, or anything like that. He's talking about the experience of transcending. And I'll show you in just a minute what he means by how he defines transcending. And he says, moreover, that he's experienced this state. He says, the divine consciousness, nous, enjoys such a life as we enjoy in our best moments. Now, that statement nails it for me. And the next one, which is just as good, if God is in that good state in which we sometimes are, this impels our wonder. And if in a better state, this compels it yet more. He's talking about being in a state that is divine, eternal, unchanging, unbounded, simple, and self-knowing. Some of the ways he describes it in the Metaphysics, this book 12, the most famous book of the Metaphysics. Actually, Aristotle didn't use the word metaphysics, he used the words first science. This is his first science. And he considered it the foundation of all the sciences, just as we consider Vedic science to be the foundation of all the sciences. And he says it's unchangeable, unalterable, unmovable, eternal, immaterial, one, the unified whole that encloses the whole nature, unifying, blissful. In this state, the divine consciousness and its object are not distinct but identical, and the consciousness is one with what it is conscious of. Now, you've heard Maharishi say probably the same exact words many times. The knower and the known are identical. Number two, consciousness and what it is conscious of are identical. It is that which is conscious of itself, self-referral. Its consciousness is a consciousness of consciousness. Perfect consciousness is conscious of its object in such a way that the consciousness and its object become one, and consciousness thus becomes its own object, so that the knower and the known are the same, that the knower and the known are identical. So it's a self-referral, self-related state of consciousness. Plato talks about it almost as clearly, but I think Aristotle just nails it out of the park. He's very, very clear about this. And he's very clear that it's a state we can know in direct experience. So how do we know eternal being? Of all places, Aristotle gives his clearest definition in the Physics. I looked and looked and looked, and I couldn't find out where he talked about it. He talks about it in the Physics. Why? Because physics, in his Physics, he makes the point that rest and activity are the basic categories for understanding nature. And all things seek a state of rest. And he gave us an example of a pendulum. The pendulum moves towards a state of rest. And for centuries, physics was based on this principle that all things in nature seek rest. Newton came up with a very new idea that a body in motion stays in motion unless it's acted on by outside forces. And that changed all of physics. But for Aristotle and for 2,000 years, physics, bodies seek a state of rest. That was Aristotle's intuition, that all things seek rest. So what about man, human knowing? The terms knowing and understanding, and I'm quoting, the terms knowing and understanding imply that the intellect has reached a state of rest and come to a standstill. So that's why he talks about it in the Physics, because the human mind, like everything in nature, seeks rest as its final state and its goal. And knowledge is produced by the soul settling down out of the activity, out of the restlessness that's natural to it, meaning that we ordinarily feel this restless activity of the mind, and coming to rest. So that he defines knowledge as gained when the soul settles down from activity to rest. That's the way Maharishi talks about it. That's the way Maharishi Patanjali talks about it in the Yoga Sutras. The mind settles down. And we'll see at the very end that even in Egypt, the Egyptians defined transcending as settling down of the activity to a state of rest. So that settling down of the activity, you can't get a more basic phrase for describing transcending. Settling down of activity to a state of rest. That's how Aristotle describes it. And I often wondered after reading, I've been reading Aristotle for many years, and I had never seen him talk about a technique. And I finally found it in the Physics, because I wasn't looking for it in the Physics, but that's where it is. That's where he describes the technique, the method. Now I'm going to move from Aristotle backwards to Plato and the pre-Socratics, and I want to just read you one statement by Socrates, but Plato quoting Socrates, of course. And now Socrates, well, there burst upon the seeker of beauty that wondrous vision of the very soul of beauty he has longed for, so longed for. It is an everlasting loveliness that neither comes nor goes, subsisting of itself and by itself in an eternal oneness. Well, the Greeks had this sense of eternal oneness. The same sense you'll find throughout the Upanishads, throughout the Vedic literature. What is the eternal oneness? Most people today in the universities, when they hear this term, coming one with the universe or eternal oneness, they say, wait a minute, what does that mean? That's a lot of mush. That's just mystical mushy-headedness. That's the common reaction when they hear this. So this idea that becoming one with the universe or becoming one with totality or the oneness of the universe, people have trouble with that. They think it's just mush-headedness and vagueness. And what does it mean, you know? Well, the Greeks were very clear. There's one reality. That is pure consciousness. And everything is I'm getting a little bit ahead of here, but everything is an excited state, a wave vibration, an excited state of that one reality. So there is only one reality. for the Greeks and for the Vedic seers. There's one ultimate reality. And you may think, well, these are just philosophical ideas. No, it's an experience. And more importantly, unified field theory in modern physics is basically saying the same exact thing. There's one reality, one field, and everything is an excited state of that field. It's a very simple integrative step to say, well, that one field that physics has described is the same identical field that's described by the Greeks and the Vedic, the Greek philosophers and the Vedic seers. It's a very exact idea that there is only one reality. Einstein says it himself, and I'll read you a quote later on if time permits. There is only one reality, the field. The field is the reality. It has many, many excited states, localized excitations that make up the world. But there's one reality, and that reality is the field. Socrates describes that in the Symposium. And Plato also talks about transcending, and he talks about a state of the self that knows itself, a hearing that hears itself, a seeing that sees itself, and a knowing that knows itself. This is in the Charmides, where he talks about that state. It's very, very clear. A seeing that sees itself, a knowing that knows itself, a self, he calls it self-related knowledge. And he says, I wonder if it's really possible to have such a thing. And he raises all sorts of questions about it. But he says, if it does some good for human life, then it must be real. And so he then goes on to show all the good that it does for human life and how people get better and live better and enjoy life more and are more effective and more able to achieve things and achieve excellence and virtue. And everything good comes from this state of self-knowing. How do we achieve it? He says we bring the mind to a state of rest. And this restores wholeness to the body and mind and cures all ills and brings wisdom and immortality. He calls this state self-related consciousness, or consciousness that knows itself, or a science of science itself. And again, Plato describes all the properties of pure consciousness. These are some of the main terms that he uses. Again, you're very familiar with them. One simple, unchanging, absolute, everlasting, stable, separate from the world, pure, colorless, formless, intangible, always one immovable, inviolable whole, not growing or decaying, not a particular thing. He describes it as perfect clarity, as a state of rest, self-related knowledge, always the same. The cause of knowledge, the power of knowing of the knower, not having a particular shape, it's not a person, it's not an entity, it's consciousness knowing itself, and that's what is ultimately real for Plato. And of course, I could take that list and I could show that it's a subset of the master list that I've given earlier. So again, this is not just a vague idea, it can be shown in a very precise way. So how does Plato say we know it? Go within. Return the self upon the self. Gather the self into itself by itself. Remember who we ultimately are. Remember Pragya Parad? It's the same theme. Awaken the knowledge asleep within us. Knowledge is there. We just have to awaken it. Socrates sees himself not as putting knowledge into empty heads, as in sitting in a classroom, but awakening the knowledge that's already there within us, asleep within us. And not only that, but bringing out the knowledge that we all possess. And he says we have to withdraw from the senses and come back to the self. That phrase, come back to the self, come back to the self, was repeated by all the Neoplatonists who understood Plato. It's there in the Rig Veda, Navarta Tvam. It's the same exact notion. Free the self, he speaks about freeing the self of the leaden weights that attach it to the body, freeing the soul, the self, from the leaden weights that attach it to the body. What are these leaden weights that attach the self to the body? You know quite well, stress. That's what attaches us to the body. It's the deep stresses that keep us bound in relativity and change so that we never transcend completely to experience the unbounded eternal bliss. And he talks about purifying the barnacles that attach the self to the body in stony accretions. You all know what barnacles are. Those little hard shells that grow on the bottom of boats and on seashores, and they're very cutting, they're very hard. Those barnacles attach themselves to us and to our body in stony accretions and make us hard and rigid and stiff so that we so that we don't transcend until we've gotten rid of the barnacles and the leaden weights that attach us to the body. Jumping now back a little further in time to Heraclitus, I have searched out myself, he says. You will not find the boundaries of the soul by traveling in any direction, so deep is the measure of it. He's saying very clearly, the self is unbounded. The self is unbounded. I have found myself, I've searched out myself, and it is unbounded. And he says, all things are one. All the pre-Socratics, practically, all of them, say all things are one. There is oneness that reigns as the fundamental reality of the universe, and that is nous, pure consciousness. For he says all things happen according to logos, which means eternal natural law. It's translated as law or logic, more often as law. Logos means eternal natural law for Heraclitus. And yet he says, men are like people of no experience. They don't have the experience. Heraclitus has had the experience. And he talks about the real constitution of things, the constitution of the universe, is accustomed to hide itself. It's unmanifest. It's hidden. By what? By thoughts, sensations, perceptions, activities that hide the underlying field of law that's the eternal basis of all change. Parmenides says that which is one, what is or has being, is one and indivisible, without beginning, entire, single, unshakable, and endless. At one point he says it rests in the same place, abiding in itself, meaning that it's not looking out, but turn back, come back upon itself. It is uncreated and indestructible, alone, complete, unmovable, and without end. For it is now, all at once, a continuous one. It's immediately in the present. And he says that consciousness and being are the same, and they are the same in each and every man. Remember the Upanishads. The self of everyone, it's the same. One simple, eternal, unchanging self, pure consciousness, being. It's the same self in everyone. Parmenides is saying the same thing, essentially. The self of everyone. And he calls it the untrembling heart of truth, or the untrembling heart of stillness. It's untrembling. It's not vibrating in thoughts, sensations, and all the sensory qualities that make up our lives. The fabric of our lives is normally made of a vast quantity of ever-changing perceptions, thoughts, feelings, decisions, memories, imaginations. And when that all settles down and it stops vibrating, the self knows itself and knows itself to be uncreated, indestructible, beyond space and time, on a deeper level than space and time. We can go beyond space and time to something deeper, to the silence of pure consciousness. Going back almost to the beginning, Anaximander, he says that the source and element of existing things is the unbounded. The source and the thing, stuff of which all things are made, is the unbounded. He calls it aperon in Greek, and it means just unbounded or infinite. And he says the unbounded is one and eternal and ageless. He also calls it God, meaning that it's conscious. It's not just some unboundedness. It's also conscious. And he says that it governs everything by the laws of nature, by the laws of justice, so that each thing that violates law has to pay reparations for its violation. In other words, as you sow, so shall you reap. Basically, I don't have the quote up there, but he basically says that. And so anyway, this was the golden age of Greece. The pre-Socratics through Socrates, Plato, and Aristotle. It was all about this. Well, it wasn't all about, because there's a lot of other stuff going on, but very clear descriptions of that state of eternal oneness that is the basis of all change. What about Pericles himself? The Golden Age of Greece is called the Periclean Age. People spoke of Pericles' magnificent composure. He was unflappable. He was undefeatable. He was the great governor general of Athens during the Golden Age. He's the one who oversaw the construction and helped design the Parthenon, as well as the great temple at Eleusis, where the Eleusinian mysteries were practiced. And Plato says of Pericles, he says, as a result, I think, of his acquaintance with Anaxagoras, another of the pre-Socratics who talks about eternal unchanging being, Pericles became imbued with high philosophy and arrived at the nature of pure consciousness, concerning which Anaxagoras often discoursed. The Greeks had a very good handle on enlightenment and consciousness, and they understood it. Nous was the name for pure consciousness. Phronesis was the name for one established in pure consciousness performing action. So they had the concept of the self and of all things, of all of life based on being established in the self. So the Golden Age of Greece, it was about 495 to 529 BCE. And it was about 490, well, I would say that that's when the real flowering of Greek civilization began. But I would say that it actually began in the early 6th century BC when the mystery religions came into Greece, as scholars say, from the East, and the pre-Socratic heritage began. So that was Greece. Now, what about Vedic India? When was India? When did the Vedic tradition flourish? Well, Max Müller, the great German scholar who translated much of the Rig Veda into English and oversaw the whole project of translating the Vedic literature into English, he once said that we don't know when the Vedic tradition began, but the earliest possible date would be about 1600 to 1800 BCE. The earliest possible date. Well, he didn't even suggest that was the date of the Vedic tradition, but that's what people picked up on, and they began repeating that. And now almost every textbook, internet, you find says that the Vedic tradition began in 1600 BC. Well, even that puts it 1,000 years before the pre-Socratics. And that's not even half of the story. It's not the whole story by any means. But people still, basically people are guessing about the dates of the Vedic tradition. And there aren't very many educated guesses because there's not many clues that tell you when things happened. There's no way to anchor the dating. Until recently, a physicist named V.N. Achar used planetarium software to date certain sky events that are described in the Mahabharata. And the Mahabharata says that during the war, the great Mahabharata war, Saturn was at Aldebaran. Aldebaran is a Well, you know, Saturn is a very slow-moving planet, and so this gives an anchor because when Achar searched in SkyMap Pro, he found 137 times when Saturn was at Aldebaran, between 500 CE and 500 BCE. He also notes that, well, the Mahabharata says that Mars was retrograded as it approached Antares, which is a bright star in, I think, the constellation of Taurus. And he searched the 137 dates that he had narrowed from the first step, and he found that this happened, that Mars was retrograded as it approached Antares 17 times. So he's narrowed it down to 17 times. And then he found a lunar eclipse near the Pleiades, followed by a solar eclipse less than 14 days later. And he searched those 17 dates, and he found two times when it happened, 3067 BCE and 2183 BCE. And then he found another event in the Mahabharata that happened only in 3067, not in 2183. So we narrowed the dates down. The Mahabharata was 3067 BCE. Now, this makes Western Indologists and scholars and archaeologists tear their hair out because they've been thinking that it was 1600 that the Vedic tradition began. Well, just recently, a lady named Saroj Bala entered Ram's chart into the, as described in the Ramayana, into this software Planetarium Gold. And she found that Ram was born in 5114 BCE. These dates are interesting because, for one, 3067 is roughly 5,000 years ago. And if you read in Maharishi's preface to the Bhagavad Gita, he says that the Bhagavad Gita was an actual event that occurred 5,000 years ago. The Mahabharata War was an actual event that occurred 5,000 years ago. So it agrees exactly with what Maharishi says, give or take a few days, a few years. It's an amazing coincidence that it agrees exactly with Maharishi. Maharishi says that the Ramayana is millions of years old, and Saroj Bala's software doesn't go back millions of years, so we'll just say it's at least 5,000 years old. But not necessarily 5,000, but at least 5,000 years old. So, move the dates way, way back from where scholars today think, if this is correct. Now, I think it's the most hard evidence that you'll find, and it's very rigorous and systematic and based on scientific technology and not on guesswork. And everything else is guesswork. And not even Max Müller believed it was 1600 BC that the Vedic tradition began. Another interesting thing is that this date of 3067 BC marks the end of the Vedic tradition. It's the beginning of Kali Yuga, the end of Sat Yuga, and the beginning of Kali Yuga in the Vedic tradition itself considers the Mahabharata War to be that's when Sat Yuga ended and Kali Yuga began. All the Vedic literature was before that. So it's the end. It's far more ancient than anyone had predicted or anticipated before. So that means the Vedic tradition was the root of the tree. You can think of the Rig Veda as the taproot, the Yajurveda and Atharvaveda and Samaveda as the second part of the root system, and then all the branches, the 40 branches of literature, of Vedic literature, or the flowering tree of Vedic civilization. And Greece, this beautiful, wonderful explosion of knowledge and light and brilliance and creativity in Greece, was one of the most marvelous fruits on the tree of Vedic knowledge. So that's a very new idea. And most Westerners do not want to think that. They like to think that civilization began here in Greece, not in India. And they'll even get angry and upset. But the evidence that I presented, I think, is quite strong that the Vedic tradition was almost exactly talking about the same method, the method of settling the activity of the mind or transcending, and the same experience, the experience of pure consciousness. And that can be shown in the most rigorous way that any humanities research can show anything. And that, I think, is the bottom line, that the Veda is far more ancient, and it is the root and the source of Greek civilization. So let's just take a few minutes quickly to look back at the Vedic tradition. You know, Plato uses this expression, coming back to the self, return to the self. You know that expression, Nivarta Tvam, in the Rig Veda. It's a scene about cows coming back from their stall, from the fields to the stalls. Come back, ye cows, come back. Well, there's one Western scholar, I won't name her because I don't want to embarrass her, but she's a very famous lady at Harvard. She thinks the Rig Veda is about cattle rustlers. Well, how off the mark can you get? The Rig Veda is about a method, a technique, coming back to the self, return. It's the same language that Plato uses. Return to the self, come back to the self. And then there's so many passages in the Rig Veda that describes that unity, that unified state. See unity and diversity. Behold one divine form appearing in many forms. Immense is his vastness, unparalleled is his glory. This was the taproot of civilization in the East and the West, I would submit. The Upanishads, just like Plato and Aristotle, the same idea is there way before 5,000 years ago. The self is not to be sought through the senses. The Creator made the senses to go out to the world outside, and therefore one looks outward and not within the self. But the wise sage, with his eyes turned inward, seeking life eternal, found the self, the eternal self. The Katha Upanishad, such a marvelous piece of Vedic literature, describes transcending as the mind coming to rest in silence. When the five senses and the mind are still, the intellect rests in silence. Plato uses that same word. You see it throughout Greek literature, resting in silence. Yajurveda, do ye expanding be united? Be ye united that win the heaven in union of heart and self, full of light and unaging. In this complete settling of the activity of the mind, all is calm, and what remains is unbounded wakefulness. It says it all to me from the Yoga Sutras. The self, without form or sound, without touch or taste or smell, is eternal and without beginning or end. When one discerns that, one is freed from the jaws of death. It's not a theory that frees us from the jaws of death, it's the experience of knowing our own self, our innermost self, as unbounded, one, simple, unchanging, eternal being. And then the Katha Upanishad again talks about going to the deeper levels of the mind. The surface is the senses, and beyond the senses are the objects of the senses, and beyond in the sense of going deeper, beyond the objects of the senses is the mind. And beyond the mind is the intellect. And beyond the intellect is the self in man, the individual self. And beyond the self in man is the unmanifest self of the universe. It's so clear right here in this one quote. It's so basic. The levels of the mind are distinguished. And we talk about going from the surface to the deeper and deeper and deeper levels. And that is how we know the unmanifest self of the entire universe. It's all the consciousness of which we are individual expressions. The one consciousness is accessible within the self because it is everywhere and it is the basis of all things. And when we settle the activity of the mind, we establish ourselves in that, and we know that as our innermost self. The one eternal pure consciousness, again from the Katha Upanishad, the one eternal pure consciousness of conscious beings, knowing this, they attain ineffable bliss, highest bliss, supreme bliss, supreme knowledge of the ultimate reality, which is the one eternal pure consciousness. So, let's come back now. Was Greece the cradle of civilization, as many people believe? Well, I think we can show that Vedic India was the source of not only Greek, but Egyptian, Sumerian, Mesopotamian, and Israeli civilization. And so I'll just give you a brief, quick tour of that point. The experience of eternal pure consciousness in ancient Egypt. This is from the Papyrus of Ani, which is from about the 12th, 13th century BCE. So it'll be a thousand years before the pre-Socratics, and almost 2,000 years after the Vedic civilization ended in Vedic India. And it says, it's called the Egyptian Book of the Dead, but it's not about death, and it's not about dying. It's, well, maybe it is in some way, but what Ani is really saying in this, Ani was a scribe. The scribes of ancient Egypt were like the seers of Vedic India and the philosophers of Greece. Ani, the scribe, says that my soul is the soul of the eternal God. Meaning, not that he is God, but that he finds God, the eternal God, deep within himself. That's his real soul, his true self. Imperishable One is my name. I am the Mighty One, the Great One, the Resting One. At rest, because the mind has come settled to a state of silence. I have lightened the darkness. That is his experience. Now, how do we know that's his experience? Well, this is the hieroglyph. And you know, hieroglyphs are actually phonetic and alphabetical rather than pictographic. And right in the middle there, it says, so clearly, if you could only read hieroglyphs, if I could read hieroglyphs, I have settled myself. I have become a spirit soul therein. I have gathered myself together like a beautiful golden hawk. You can imagine a hawk coming in and lighting on a branch and then sort of settling his feathers, ruffling around until he's settled and sleek. I have become a still heart. I am master over myself. How do the Egyptians gain this state? I have settled myself. The same word that Aristotle uses and that is used in the Yoga Sutras. The settling of the activity of the mind. That's how it was gained in ancient Egypt. And Gilgamesh, you've all heard of Gilgamesh. For many years, centuries, it was thought to be the most ancient book of the world. It's not. The Rig Veda is much more ancient. Gilgamesh was the man to whom all things were known. This was from the Epic of Gilgamesh. He was wise. He saw mysteries. He knew secret things. Gilgamesh is he who saw the deep. Well, what does that mean? Well, for a long time, scholars thought, well, he saw the ocean. The ocean, that's what the deep means. He saw the ocean. Big deal, he saw the ocean? That's nothing to write about. Well, for a long time, the opening line of the Epic of Gilgamesh was missing. Up into the 90s, late 90s, it was missing. And finally, this American scholar named Craftsman found the missing line in the British Museum, searching thousands of manuscripts and fragments. He found the opening line from the Epic of Gilgamesh. And what it literally says is that Gilgamesh was he who saw the Nagbu. So I looked up Nagbu in the Chicago Assyrian Dictionary, and it translates Nagbu as the totality, the spring, the fountain, or the source. Gilgamesh was he who dived into the deep and found the source, the totality, the spring, the fountain. He found the source of all things. Doesn't say pure consciousness, but that's what he found. He dived into the Nagbu and found the source. He saw totality. And that's why he can strangle lions like he does. And in Judaism, you probably know this very well. Be still and know that I am God. That is this one of the Psalms of David. And when Moses is leading the children of Israel out of bondage in Egypt, he comes to the Red Sea, and the Egyptian armies are coming fast, and the Israelis are the freed slaves are thinking they're going to be destroyed. And Moses says to them, he reminds them of the principle, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord. The Lord will fight for you. You don't have to bother. You need only be still. Be still and know that that was the principle that Moses taught the people, the children of Israel. Be still and know that I am God. Commune on your own with your own heart upon your bed. In other words, first thing up in the morning, sit up and meditate and be still, be silent, be quiet. The Hebrew for being still, silent, and quiet is all the same. They're intertranslatable. Stand thou still a while that I may show you the word of God. Be still. And that's how you'll know the word of God. Don't read the scriptures. Go be still. You know, be still. Transcend. Settle the mind. Set yourselves, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord. The blessed man delights in the law of the Lord, and in his law doth he meditate day and night. I don't think it means thinking. I think it means settling the activity of the mind to be in that state of complete stillness. In sitting still and rest shall ye be saved. In quietness and in confidence shall be your strength. So that's the presentation that I wanted to share with you. And if you have any questions, I'd be delighted to hear them. And so please come up and speak into the mic so we can record them. And
is it
a true Greek scholar here? We have Rhoda R. Johnson.
I'm going to talk about all this in my talk on Wednesday night, Cupid and Psyche, because she goes into the inner world and becomes enlightened. But my question is about folk tales. Is there any evidence that you know of that Indian folk tales were also known as well as these principles of transcending and being still and all of that? And the reason I ask is there's a folk tale from India called Tulisa and Banak Dao, and it's a Shiva Parvati story. Woodsman's Daughter, it's also called. And her invisible husband is a serpent, but it's Shiva. So there are echoes of that in the Golden Ass, in the Cupid and Psyche story, in the Golden Ass.
Yes.
And so it's very clear to me that Apuleius in 120 CE, Common Era, knew that folktale. So I'm just wondering if you have any knowledge of that, of folktales as well as the Vedas and so forth being around in Greece and then later in Rome.
That's a good question. I've looked into it a little bit. You probably have found much more than I, and so we'll come to your talk on Thursday night.
Wednesday
night, sorry. And so, yes, I'm sure there's a lot to be found there. Just the fact that the Mahabharata and the Ramayana are these two great epics. One is about a man who loses his wife and then goes to war to get her back, and the other is about a great battle. The Iliad and the Odyssey are also about the same kind of thing. And one scholar, an Irish scholar from the 19th century, says that the meter of the Rig Veda and the Homeric epics are the same meter, essentially. Mm-hmm. I think there's probably some traffic between India and Greece. There's a lot of evidence. Even by the first century, there was 50 tons of pepper and lapis shipped from India to Greece, and so there was plenty of commerce and plenty of opportunity.
Yeah. And folk tales.
And stories passed back and forth.
Yeah, and folk tales and songs, popular things, would be very likely to travel because people sing, they tell stories. Not everyone's a philosopher. So I think it's quite likely.
Yeah, I think that folk tales will probably should prove to tell the story in a different genre, in a different idiom. But philosophers are more explicit. I mean, they use the same language as the Vedic. And I'm not trying to say that they copied the Greeks copied the Veda, but that they were drawing from the same well of experience.
That's the language that applies to the experience.
Yes. Okay,
thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Dr. Chandler, I first want to congratulate you on what I believe is a spectacular achievement. I truly believe.
Thank you.
I believe it's the beginning in this era of a re-examination and a revision of all of Western civilization, the way history is viewed and understood. It truly is a work worthy of a lifetime of study and writing as you've done. I did have a question. I see that the knowledge, in some way, there was a fragmentation. And one of the most fascinating aspects of Greece is that Sparta and Athens could be so different, that they were polar opposites. And I was thinking of the funeral oration of Pericles that Thucydides wrote, and how he said that Athens was the school of Hellas, and that in a way, maybe Athens was the peace palace for all of Hellas, and that somehow Sparta had lost that knowledge or in some way got in opposition to it. So just if you care to comment on that.
It's an interesting thought. I hadn't really thought much about the difference between Athens and Peloponnesia, which is they're very close, they're neighbors, they're joined by land and very close together. I don't know why Sparta would be so different. I hadn't thought about that, so maybe you can figure that one out. Yes, this is the final. It's actually appeared. I started working on this years ago. I won't say how many years, but the first volume is out now. Veda in Greece. It's not quite out. It's still in the proofing stage. It's being proofed, but this is a proofing copy, and so you see the a little glimpse of the Temple of Delphi, Temple of Athena at Delphi, and the Ganga. And so this unbounded sky comes down and flows into the the Greek civilization. Consciousness, science, and civilization. The experience of pure consciousness in the great classics of East and West. In volume one, this is just volume one, Veda in Greece. And volume two will be on the unity of religion, starting with the Egyptians, Sumerians, going right up through Judaism and all of China, Lao Tzu and Confucius and Buddha, the whole Buddhist tradition, and then Christianity, Islam, and finally the American Indians and all the indigenous cultures around the world that describe this, the same knowledge. It's in everything. I'm totally amazed. That's why I could, I'm not a scholar. The reason I could write this book is I just got totally psyched totally awed to discover that this Vedic knowledge permeates our Western civilization as well as the East. And so I spent all this time writing books when I never intended to. It wasn't my intention to write long books. I just I just found that it permeates every fabric of Western civilization. Volume 3 is on the Renaissance to the present. It's mostly Western thought. It goes through Descartes, Leibniz, Spinoza, Galileo, Kepler, Newton, Maxwell, Einstein, Schrödinger, Jeans, Eddington. And there's over 330 people that I found, and I stopped when I hit that number. It's like a magic number. I said, I can't do this anymore. I got to write it. I got to finish it. Got to publish it. But anyway, it'll be available, I would think, in another month or two. Hopefully, the proofing goes very quickly. I find it very, very difficult to proof the footnotes, especially the endnotes, especially of a long volume. Let me say one other thing about this, though. It looks big, and it is big, but it's also very manageable because there's a very short introduction on Maharishi's Vedic science and the experience of transcending, and then each chapter is a chapter you can read independently of the others. So if you only read one chapter, you can read them all in sequence, and that's the best way to read it, but you can read any one or two or three at your leisure, and you don't need to read it, sit down and read it all. You know, it would be a bit much. Okay, any other questions? Yes.
Actually, two things. One is, you used the word virtue at one time. You used the word virtue.
Yes,
Sometime. And some ancient history course, or what this professor thought was ancient history, meaning starting with Greece, he used that word and said that the word was arete.
Yes. That's,
and I don't know, I know only a little bit about Sanskrit, but, you know, Shankar Acharya, you know, the AR term as being something. Anyway.
Interesting thought.
And the other, I have a question. On an early slide, you said something about there was several seers from the East who came to Greece. Can you say some more about that?
Yes. Good. So first let's start with arete, is the Greek word for, it's translated as both virtue and excellence. And the Greeks saw them as almost the same because the excellence and virtue come from the same source of experience of pure consciousness. So arete expresses that excellence in action, which is attained, and moral virtue, which is attained by becoming established in the self and being. So it's an interesting thought that acharya comes, that might be the same root. There's so many roots in Greek that are very, very similar to Sanskrit roots. So that's a very good thing to pursue, very good line of thinking. And the second question?
The five seers or something like that.
Oh, well, there were two people. Well, at one point I asked, well, can we trace how the Vedic influence came into Greece? And I thought for years, I thought, well, it's just lost in the fog of time. It's too ancient. We'll never find it. And then I began seeing these Pythagoras, who was one of the early pre-Socratics, who lived around 550 maybe, 525 to 550. Pythagoras, who was the founder of the mathematical tradition of Greece, he believed, well, when he was a young man, his teacher, Thales, thought he was going to be a great seer and a great, and he suggested that he go to Egypt and be initiated into the mysteries of the Egyptian mysteries. So he set sail, according to Iamblichus in the ancient world, he set sail for Egypt, and the sailors on the ship decided to kidnap him because he was obviously wealthy and they were going to sell him for ransom. And he sat still the whole time on the whole voyage. He sat unmoving for the whole voyage. And they were so impressed that when they got to Egypt, instead of kidnapping him, they built an altar and worshipped him because they had decided that he was a god in human form. And he was obviously a very integrated person who meditated the whole voyage to make the voyage easier. Well, Pythagoras got to Egypt with a few associates, one of whom was Zalmoxis, and they were captured in Egypt and taken to Baghdad. And they escaped from Baghdad and went into Persia and into India, and apparently spent some time in India, came back to Greece. This was in the 6th century. And when they got back to Greece, Pythagoras established a school in southern Italy, and Zalmoxis established a school in Thrace, and that's where he built this palace, a cave under his palace, and spent all his time there. He gave the laws of Thrace to Thrace from a cave. So he was obviously determined to spend most of his time in a cave, meditating, I presume. And Socrates says in the Charmides that it was from Zalmoxis, from ministers in the court of Zalmoxis, because it would have been a generation earlier, or two, a generation or two earlier. He says that he learned this technique of daily repeating a fair word or a sound from the ministers of the king, minister court of King Zalmoxis. So that's probably the best evidence we have of where, how it came into technique, how the technique came in. Because at least from Socrates, the Pythagorean school in Italy and the school in Thrace, both had been to India. So I think that's the best I can find to explain it. Also, scholars say the mystery religions came into Greece in the early 6th century from the East. And it doesn't specify where in the East, but ultimately it's got to be the Vedic East, and that's the beginning of the whole thing. But the Vedic East was the source of the technique that was passed on by the mystery religions. Now the mysteries, you probably know, the mysteries of Eleusis, very famous in antiquity. Even by Roman times, not only was Pericles an initiate in the mysteries, the Greek dramatists, Aeschylus and Sophocles and Euripides, all had been initiated, and Sophocles was a mystery priest. They called it initiation, and it was passed on secretly, just like it is today. I mean, we proclaim it from the housetops, but when it comes to the details of the technique, it's always passed on in private. And it was in ancient times also, not only in ancient Egypt and in ancient India, but in ancient Greece. In Greece, it was prohibited by law to tell the mystery secret on penalty of death. It was taken very seriously. Greek law supported the mysteries. Well, even by Roman times, Caesar and Marcus Aurelius and Hadrian and I don't know how many emperors had gone to Eleusis from Rome, from Italy, to be initiated. And Cicero said that the mysteries were the greatest gift of Athens to civilization. Not democracy, not this magnificent temple architecture, or the Olympic Games, or anything else. It was the mysteries, the greatest gift of Athens to civilization. What were they? Well, everybody says we don't know, that's all secret. It was kept secret. But one thing I found out from this amazing scholar who's very highly respected, named Carl Carini, is that after initiation, well, half of the population of Athens went to Eleusis to be initiated. And they went through these great processions and walked from the Parthenon, the top of the Parthenon, down the 12 miles to Eleusis to be initiated. And not all at once, but over the course of years, half of the population of Athens was initiated. That explains the explosion of brilliance that made Greece great. It wasn't just a few philosophers. The philosophers gave voice to what they experienced, but it was the mysteries that made it available to the wide population. So that's how that's the key, I think, to understanding how the technique. Now, we don't know exactly. The mysteries all had techniques. The mysteries of Egypt, the mysteries of Anatolia, the mystery of the Great Mother, the mysteries of Greece, the mysteries of Rome. All the different lands had different mysteries. But what was common, the lesser mysteries all tried to get people established in the religion by talking about the God who had sacrificed himself for them. The story of Prometheus. Prometheus suffered for mankind every day. An eagle came and tore out his liver, and he regenerated by night. He suffered again the next day. This went on for thousands of years. He was suffering for mankind. And this endeared people to the God who had suffered for them. The Egyptian religion of Isis says, he died for your sins. And that appeal was made by all the mysteries. And they got people into the mystery. And then when they proved themselves worthy, morally, to go on to the greater mysteries, they were allowed to be initiated into the greater mystery. And they all had a greater mystery. That was the prototype of the greater mysteries. And of course, Christianity, you can see how it fits into that. And Paul adopted the same pattern, essentially, and also taught a greater mystery of Christianity. He says so. There was a greater mystery of Christianity, but at a certain point, 52 AD, Paul said in his letter to the Corinthians, you're all not moral enough, you're not ready for this technique, for the greater mystery. You're sleeping around, you're doing all these horrible things, I'm not going to give it to you, you're not ready for it. And so I'm only going to talk about Jesus and him crucified. So he reverted back to the first level, phase one mystery. Didn't give out the higher mystery, the greater mystery. And so Christianity took on a life of its own as a lesser mystery without the greater mystery. But the Greeks and the Romans and the Egyptians and five or six different mystery traditions had both a lesser mystery and a greater mystery. And that was how the knowledge spread so widely in the ancient world. That's why there's all this tremendous creativity in Greece and in Rome. Marcus Aurelius says, dig down deep within yourself where the source of goodness is ever welling up. He also practiced that technique. And he describes unity consciousness brilliantly. And Seneca says, withdraw into yourself and go down into that deep silence, for that's the source of refreshment to your souls. So it's in Seneca, it's in Marcus Aurelius, Plotinus and Proclus, the whole of Rome and the Roman tradition, right way up to the end of, till the fall of Rome, it was about transcending. That's what the ancient world was about. And it got lost when phase one mystery replaced the phase three mystery and became so powerful that it took over the world. Which is, you know, it's very easy to just put the phase two mystery back, maybe, and revive the whole thing. So I don't think it's all lost, but it's certainly been suppressed for a long time. Anyway, very good questions. Yes. Oh, sorry.
You mentioned that there was evidence for the, say, 3000 BC, loosely, for the Mahabharata. But that doesn't necessarily mean, does it, that all the other Vedic literature, the Upanishads, and that they could have come way later? I mean, I'm just asking, I'm not saying.
It's a good question. I'm assuming that because the Vedic tradition speaks of the Mahabharata war as like the end of the classical golden age of India, that everything came before then. I mean, it's possible. I've seen people put the Upanishads in the 4th century AD, you know. I mean, it's all over the place on the internet. If you look, people are just guessing. And so this is the first anchor, the first firm anchor we have, 3000 BC, 3067. It's a good anchor point, I think, if it holds up to scrutiny. And I think it's pretty hard evidence. So the question is was that the end of the classical period? And the Indian tradition says yes, it's the end of the classical period. that was the end of the Golden Age. It was the end of, it was the beginning of Kali Yuga. So if Kali Yuga begins in 5000 BC, the Upanishads, which are far closer to the Rig Veda and the Yajurveda and the Atharva Veda, that whole wellspring out of the Rig Veda and the four Vedas into the Upanishads, it's pretty direct. And it's very, very ancient. I think that it would be at least before 5000 BC. Because this book by Saroj Bala that describes the Ramayana as 5000, that is I haven't had a chance to read it all yet, but she says that the stars Valmiki describes as Ram's birth chart only occurred in that year 5114 or whatever it is, and that date becomes it's on the same day of the year and the same hour of the day that is celebrated in India today. So it's totally amazing that this evidence seems to be quite strong that these are very ancient, far more ancient. And of course the Ramayana, I would say, is way after the Upanishads. Now, there's just no way of dating the other. We got dating for two books, and that helps, I think. But the Upanishads, just no evidence for when they... There's no internal or external evidence that anybody has found that really nails it down as clearly as these two. So, good question.
Where will your book be available when it's...
Amazon.
Okay.
So thank you for that marvelous integration of art and ideas. I'm sure you know that the Ramayana is supposed to be in Treta Yuga. And if you look at the Vedic chronology of the yugas, that puts it back, I figured it out once, according to what's in Maharishi's Bhagavad Gita, it's over 1 million years ago.
A million?
Yeah, over 1 million years
ago. Yeah, Maharishi says that, I think.
So that's one comment. Another comment is...
I'm just saying it's at least 5,000, yeah, according to the best ability of our astronomical programs to calculate.
There's a book in our library that you may already know about, but I think it would interest you. It's by Thomas McEvely. He's an art critic, but he started as a classicist. It's about 500 pages going into all the connections between ancient India and ancient Greece. I forget the name of the book, but
I'll look for that.
McEvely.
I have a chapter on the connections. There are lots of interesting connections. Just to go back to Rhoda's point about, just briefly, one interesting story is that Plato uses this metaphor of chariot driving through the heavens, and there's two horses, appetite and sense, and the driver of the chariot is reason. And when sense and appetite get out of hand, too much appetite, too much sensation, the chariot gets out of control and the driver falls into earth and is reincarnated or incarnated as a human being. Same exact metaphor occurs in the Upanishads, exactly the same. So there are stories that also show links, but I think there's more than just cultural links and historical links. I think there's a link of knowledge that's very basic, this method of transcending that can be used to get... I think the real significance of what I've been doing is this, the discovery that the Vedic and the Greek tradition came up with a method of knowledge that gives knowledge of a very basic kind that is universal across all cultures. It's not about just history. It's about knowledge. And Maharishi calls it Vedic science. It permeates the Greek tradition, the Roman tradition, and Descartes all the way through the present. And you'll find Leonardo da Vinci and Francis Bacon and Democritus all making that distinction between knowing through the senses and knowing through going within the self, transcending activity, experiencing eternal being, and knowing and watching and witnessing how eternal being generates the universe out of itself. And that, Plotinus and Proclus go way into that issue of how the one becomes the many, Plato, Plotinus, Proclus, and it's exactly, almost exactly, well, I won't say exactly, very, very similar to the way Maharshi describes the sequential emergence of the many from the one. Yes, David.
When half of Athens had the high mysteries or were meditating, was that a period of peace for them, or were they invincible? Did they have a Maharshi effect from that?
Very good question, and I think the answer is yes. I think what I don't have it in front of me. I can look it up, but Pericles built a temple at Eleusis that was 50 yards by 50 yards, 50 meters by 50 meters. That's as big as a football field. Now, it's true that once a year there was a procession from Athens down to Eleusis, and lots of people were initiated. They brought their sheepskins. They sat with their eyes closed after initiation on their sacred sheepskin. And so there was an initiation, and there are caves right next to the temple. Two big wide-mouthed caves with a ledge, and it's worn smooth from sitting. And so people meditated in those caves, and I suspect that there was a group meditating in Eleusis year-round. Otherwise, why would they build a building 50 yards by 50 yards for just one day of initiation? No way. I mean, that was used for something. Plus, I mean, it was used, I think it was a year-round group at Eleusis. And it was during that time, during the Periclean Age, Athens became virtually invincible. Eleusis is 11 miles from Athens, so it's basically a suburb. Greece became like invincible. And Pericles was the enlightened leader of that time. And Plato and Aristotle were the enlightened seers. And so I think it was a very enlightened culture, and that Eleusis probably had a group. Now, there was a legend that whenever there was a great war, when the Persians invaded at the great battles, you know, the Battle of Thermopylae and Marathon, when a small handful of Greeks fended off these huge masses of a million Persians or something, the legend was that the Greeks, that the group at Eleusis, that Eleusis was what gave power to the forces that defended Greece from the Persians, and that the Persian armies were defeated by the Greeks because forces out of Eleusis, some subtle forces, went and aided the Greeks in their battle against the Persians. So that this golden age, which came about in part because the Greeks defeated the Persians and were able to enjoy a period of peace and prosperity and wealth, that whole period was very, very, well, the Greeks saw the Eleusis as the source of their civilization, the basis of not only individual glory, but the collective glory of Greece. And they believed that that their success was due to what was going on at Eleusis. And so it was like a group for government, very much like that, I think. And it's hard to prove because a lot of the evidence is circumstantial. But why did Pericles, who built the Parthenon, build a temple 11 miles from Athens that was dedicated 500? I mean, that's just a football field. It's a huge building right next to a cave. And it had been built next to the cave because for centuries people, after they were initiated, practiced meditation in the cave. They sat on their sacred sheepskins and practiced meditation. So I think it's a very good question. And it's partly circumstantial, but I have a very strong feeling that that's what Eleusis was, a group for government, a Maharshi effect kind of phenomenon. Yes.
That was brilliant. I am impressed with your presentation and think it has a lot of potential and interesting people in learning about TM. When we've had this course, Know Thyself, the Know Thyself course that happens every spring here, it's been very well attended, especially by college-age people. And I was thinking that you're adding a lot of power, possibly, if we could use some of your concepts to help promote on campuses this concept, where people are very aware of and taught a lot about the importance of the Greek philosophers. The question that I'm a little concerned about getting pushback on is the translation of the word nous as consciousness rather than reason, or I forgot the other word you said. I was wondering if you could go a little bit more into detail on why you feel justified in translating that as consciousness, or if it would it work to translate it as reason, would it still work in the context of explaining pure consciousness and transcending?
Good question. The answer is that the entire philosophical tradition from the pre-Socratics right through Plato and Aristotle, they describe the state of nous as one, simple, unchanging, eternal, unbounded. Now, if it's one and simple, well, what oneness means is that there's no multiplicity. What simple means is there's no complex sequence of thinking. That's one reason. The other thing is that the Greeks had a word for intellect, and they used that separately. And when they meant that which is one, simple, and unchanging, they used the word nous. And that was consistent throughout the pre-Socratics up through Plato and Aristotle. By the time of Plotinus and Proclus, which is 1,000 years later, nous also meant eternal natural law, or the eternal diversity of natural law, which is not one and simple, but that's just how the word evolved over time. But nous meant one, simple, unchanging, and eternal. And I think that there's a lot of brilliance among the Greeks because they were able, especially in Aristotle, he was able to identify, even though it's one, simple, and it's just the mind silent and at rest, he's able to see in it that it's consciousness conscious of itself, the knower is identical with the known, and all these other points that I brought out. And that is an analytical, that's Aristotle's keen analytical mind at work, that he was able to identify that structure of pure consciousness. Always one, simple, and changing, nowhere and known are identical, self-referral, consciousness is conscious of consciousness. And there was a second part of your question? Yeah. What was it?
Remember? I've forgotten it a bit.
I'll think of it in a minute. It was a good point, but yes, Kelly.
I think you'll be able to answer. You have all the answers to all these questions, but how much are you going to be able to engage the academic world with this presentation?
We'll see. I'll tell you this. Just this last weekend, I went to a residence course called a retreat now in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. And there were 15 medical students, medical doctors, CEOs, judges, and it was a professional course. And they loved it. And they were all, and yeah, of course, they were all meditating.
They were all meditators.
So the next, my next step, I'm hoping, is to take it, I'm hoping to go to University of Chicago, Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Stanford.
Oh, that'd be great.
And then just see. Because, you know, it's going to be very interesting, because this flies in the face of everything people believe, you know. It goes, doesn't it, David? I mean, it's like, this is just not, it's almost universally assumed that philosophy was an intellectual enterprise.
Right, right.
And people hate the idea that somebody who sits and meditates can get the knowledge that they got from years and years of study.
Right, right. And Aristotle is revered as more practical or intellectual than Plato, and yet you like Aristotle better. Now that's interesting.
Well, they're both very great thinkers. Plato was much more of a literary master, and Aristotle was more of a scientist. But they were both talking about the same thing, the same pure consciousness. But how this will fly outside of MIU, we'll see. That's all I can. I think, you know, there has to be a lot of buy-in. People have to buy in to Marcy's describe the stages of development of human consciousness. He's identified what pure consciousness is and identified these stages of development. And I think the world is softening up.
I do too.
And that there will be some receptivity. I expect there will be, but I don't know. I don't know yet.
But I'm also excited about the fireworks that you might be able to create.
There'll be some fireworks, I think. I hope they're all beautiful. Okay. Well, any more questions? One last question. Well, thank you so much for coming. I've really enjoyed this.